This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Artist Fahamu Peku has been wrestling with stereotypes of black masculinity for his entire life. No matter how many degrees he earned or what job he was doing, he had the sense that he was only seen as a black body. And he's always used his art as a way to push back, but for a long time did not touch one particularly charged topic, police-involved shootings of black men. That changed in 2015 after a police officer shot and killed Walter Scott, a black man in Charleston. Fahamu started work on a series called Do or Die, Affect Ritual Resistance. It debuted in Charleston in 2016, since then has traveled around the country, and now is at the Sonia Haynes Stone Center for Black Culture and History at UNC Chapel Hill. Fahamu Peku is an interdisciplinary artist and scholar based in Atlanta, and he joins us now. Fahamu Peku, welcome to The State of Things.
Thank you for having me, Frank. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us what we will see at that exhibit in Chapel Hill.
Sure. So the exhibition, Do or Die, wrestles with the spectacle of black death, which is something that has been a sort of pervasive imposition of black existence for centuries, really, when you think about it. And what I've attempted to do is to create a body of work that engages this spectacle, but rather than feed into the spectacle and the trauma that it causes for people to have, I wanted to do something that would instead usher in hope and provide a way for black people and others to see ourselves as something other than tragic victims, as something other than fragile bodies that could be broken or destroyed by white supremacy.
And that is an art, because it seems to me the way we need to call attention to this is to show it in all of its brutal trauma in the hope that we might see change. But as you say, this simply adds to the trauma and it can stereotype the victim. How do you do that? How do you go about showing hope in the face of a situation like this?
Well, one of the first questions that I began to ask myself as I was developing this body of work is, how did black people or our African ancestors approach the question of death? How did we approach wrestling with the very fact of life, that people do die? I think in the context of Western civilization, where largely black people have been oppressed and marginalized, our relationship to death has become perverted and distorted due to the types of violence and trauma that has been levied against us. And so when I began asking myself those questions, I began to reflect on my own relationship to an African spiritual practice called Ifa, and thinking about the way that life and death and the balance between the two are articulated within that practice, understanding the relationship that we have to our living ancestors. And I found beauty and I found hope. And I wanted to bring those ideas to bear within this body of work.
So give us a sense of how you reflect that, these spiritual concepts that are located in Ifa. How are they then embodied in your work?
Sure. So one of the central pieces of this exhibition is a full body mask that I call the New World Egungun. And in the Ifa tradition, or in the Yoruba tradition, and in many Central and West African cultures, you have these full body masquerades for the ancestors. The word egungun literally translates to the power concealed. And these full body masks give shape and form to our ancestral spirits, which would otherwise not be visible to the physical eye. This New World egungun that I created is patterned and modeled after a traditional egungun masquerade, but with some slight differences that bring it more into a sort of modern dialect. But the egungun masquerade is very significant because the egungun are performed to work with issues that might arise in the community. They're performed to bring about healing when there's trouble and trauma in the community. They're performed to remind us of our connection to our ancestral spirits. And so I found that, I felt that, in creating this New World egungun, I could sort of, begin to challenge, you know, again, this kind of spectacle of death by, you know, reanimating and reactivating the spirits of these violently departed souls and, you know, move them from the position of being seen as tragic victims to being honored ancestors.
Tell me how you first learned about the this African spiritual tradition.
Sure. Right around the time that I graduated from college, I had begun experimenting with these portraits that were the faces of people that just really sort of appeared in my mind. And often my friends would say, you know, who's that? And I couldn't really tell them who it was or really why I was doing what I was doing. But I felt very much compelled that what I was doing was a very spiritual exercise. And I would draw these faces. I would, you know, replace the eyes with broken glass so there would be this sort of like reflective quality in them. I would often find feathers on the ground as I would walk to and from my day job, and I would incorporate these feathers into the work. And for me, those feathers were symbols or signs from, you know, guardian spirits who I felt were watching over me, and they would leave these feathers as a way for me to be reminded that they were there. Anyway, one day I was in my office, and a friend of mine who I hadn't seen in a few years came by, and he was dressed in all white. And I remember asking him, you know, why are you dressed like that? And he was like, well, I just returned from Nigeria. I've been initiated to become a Babalawo in Ifa tradition. And I had never heard of this before. I wasn't familiar with what he's talking about. So I was, you know, kind of grilling him a little bit and asking for more information. And as we were talking, my receptionist overheard us, and she came around the corner and she was like, you're a Babalawo? Oh, my dad is a Babalawo. And so now the two of them are having this conversation, and I'm looking between the two of them like, what are y'all talking about? Well, you know, after my friend left, my receptionist told me that her father's Ile, the temple that he practiced at, was, you know, not far from where we lived, and she offered to take me there. And this particular Sunday was the first Sunday of the month, and this was the Sunday that was dedicated to venerating the ancestors at this particular Ile. And when we arrived, you know, I got to the door, you know, you have to remove your shoes. And as I stepped across the threshold, I instantly felt at home. And it's really hard to describe that feeling because, mind you, you know, as a child growing up, I was, you know, I grew up in a Baptist church. I was always in the church. You know, when that didn't feel quite enough for me, I experimented with other spiritual practices like Islam, and I even looked into Buddhism and, you know, other faiths, and just really trying to find my way. So when I entered this temple, it was, like I said, it was like an instant feeling of like comfort and belonging. And as the service, you know, continued throughout that day, you know, people shared different information about the ancestors, how we venerate them, why it's necessary, what does it look like, the icons and the symbols, and, you know, just the different ways that, you know, this type of work is done within the practice. And as I listened to people speak, everything that they were saying was things that I was doing in my artwork. It was like all of a sudden I discovered the language for what it is that I was doing, and I felt completely at peace. And I, you know, never looked back.
You know, it's interesting to think about this, and I've always been curious about what happens in spiritual traditions when the iconography is taken out of its context and brought to another place, and whether or not it can have the same healing power because it's outside of its cultural context, in which the belief and the faith in that system is, in some ways, to my mind, and I think I've seen research on this, the power really lies in the sort of the cultural belief and the communal understanding of the icons and the cultural context. What happens when you take Igungun masks out of context and put them in a museum, for instance?
Yeah, I think those kinds of questions are really really essential, especially as we, you know, even if we go further and we talk about the sort of looting of African cultures of right. their, you know, artworks. You know, most of those artifacts that we find in museums like the British Museum and, you know, all across Paris, like a lot of those artifacts that we find are actually spiritual right. objects and you know, embody a lot of spiritual meaning and cultural meaning. But with this particular work and specifically with Ifa, I think one of the things that's been really interesting in my studies and research about the practice and about the system is that this a sort of pliability is actually woven into the practice, in that there are, of course, there are structures and organizations, there are rituals, there are rules. But all of those are within the understanding that things change, that people change, that people move, that people grow. And Ifa is one of these kinds of practices that is pliable enough that it can grow and move with you wherever you are. And I think it's a really powerful testament to the veracity of the system, in that, you know, it was able to travel across the Atlantic Ocean in very traumatic fashion into the Americas, into Brazil, into the Caribbean, and still maintain its power for those enslaved ancestors who oftentimes, you know, found ways to disguise their practices by hiding it behind the veil of Catholicism, or hiding it behind the veil of other religions and spiritual practices, and such practicing this Ifa tradition and these Ifa customs in secret, but through the lens of other practices. And I think, you know, in those ways, the practice has grown and expanded, and, you know, continues to be a thriving faith practice that is practiced all over the world today.
Hence the title, Do or Die: Affect Ritual Resistance. It is. You see it as a form of resistance in its current context.
Oh, most certainly. I think, you know, any form of maintaining one's cultural identity, one's cultural voice, one's cultural memory in the face of the kinds of, again, traumas and oppressions that have been weighed against us is a form of resistance. You know, again, very wisely, you know, our ancestors found ways to preserve the things that made them who they were and that make us who we are today. And there's a very deep, you know, resistance in that subtlety, in that creativity, in that ingenuity. And I think that it's essential for, you know, for us, the children of those ancestors, to have an understanding of that and to embody that and to embrace that and to articulate that in the work that we do.
And as we said, your work took a turn in this direction particularly after the killing in 2015, the police killing of Walter Scott in Charleston. You first exhibited this work in Charleston a year later in 2016. Because it was quite a reception. It was more than just an exhibit. So talk about the way it was unfolded and the reaction that it got.
Sure. The exhibition actually opened with a performance of the New World Egungun in what's called an elevation ritual. And the Egungun began a procession from the riverfront in downtown Charleston to honor the lives of the enslaved Africans who died in the Middle Passage. And then began a procession down King Street in downtown Charleston, even stopping at Emmanuel AME Church, which is the site where nine parishioners were killed by a white supremacist in the summer of 2016, and then on into the museum space to open the exhibition. And in this elevation ritual was the literal transformance and transference of these deceased beings from being tragic victims to honor ancestors, to bring down their power and to embody that power within the mask and to use that as a way to not only articulate this notion of resistance and this notion of ritual, but also the power that is embodied in an understanding of how our ancestors contribute to those of us who are here and present in the physical world now.
That was certainly your intention. What was the reaction?
The reaction was spectacular. You know, we did, of course, announce that this procession would be happening, but it took on a life of its own as it began because, you know, again, you know, seeing this mask moving down the street in downtown Charleston in the middle of, you know, a rush hour traffic, it began to draw a huge crowd of people who just, you know, were following the sounds of the drums and the chanting and the movement. The crowd really swelled to great numbers by the time we reached the gallery, and I think it was really transformative for a lot of people to be able to see something of that, something like that, to see a performance like that, or to see a ritual like that take place, because it again, you know, a part of what I'm attempting to do in this work is not just you know, honor our past, but to celebrate the way that the past connects to us right here and now, but also propels us into our future selves and into what we can be.
And you yourself are a primary subject in a lot of your work. We can see you in your work, but you say they're not really self-portraits. Tell us more about that.
Yes, that's correct. I do use my body in the work, but what I'm ultimately doing is performance. So every painting, every project, any work that I do always begins with a photo shoot where, you know, I give a concept to my photographer and, you know, I perform in front of the camera based on those concepts, based on the ideas or the stereotypes or whatever the subject matter is that I'm attempting to address. And then the ultimate ultimate role of that performance is to become the final pieces, the paintings or the drawings or the installations that you see when you are in the space. But again, this is me performing as a character, as an ideal of Black masculinity, and not necessarily about me personally.
Well, it's fascinating. It's fascinating stuff. Fahamu Peku is an interdisciplinary artist and a scholar based in Atlanta, and you can see his series Do or Die, Affect Ritual Resistance at the Sonia Haynes Stone Center for Black Culture and History at UNC Chapel Hill until November 21st. Fahamu, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a great pleasure.
You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. The State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Grant Hullab-Moorman. Robin Copley is our technical director. Josie Taras is our intern. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.